Dropouts, greatly reduced. Arrests, greatly reduced. Welfare, these children here in this report now are wage earning ages now. Literacy, employment, and vocational school or on to college. In addition to that, there are a couple more items here which I think are rather interesting. In the experimental group, there were 64 teen pregnancies. In the control group, and they matched the control and experimental group very closely, there were 117 pregnancies, you see. So these are the impacts here that we have on this. So very briefly, because we're in a shortage of time, what our proposal is that if monies were expended for a child development program, which has been on the books but underfunded for, I'm told, about 15 years, we could expect to see rather quickly better climate in our communities and also a tremendous savings in money. For instance, one of the savings here, you've got special education, these other matters here, which is saying it didn't work the first time, so we'll try to teach them a second time. In this study, they followed the youngsters through school, and the savings in the school budget was 17%. In Salem, we expend on general funds and on capital development something like $160 million a year. That savings in just the town of Salem alone would amount to something like $23 million. So you see this, we perceive this to very important as needing to get at the heart of it. And for that reason, we urge you to look carefully at the child development program, behind which, of course, are the child development specialists who are yearning for some money to do the things which would begin to let them deal with this massive problem, whereas now it's only token. I'll try to answer any questions.
Well, I think we're very supportive of what are called early education and before that even pre-kindergarten programs.
Yeah.
And one of the things we really have to look at, always very supportive of programs and use figures like this. One of the things we have to look at, we have that the Perry School program was a quality program, well funded, highly funded.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, our Head Start programs in Oregon, both the ones we funded by the state last time and the federal ones, are not particularly well funded. They really are working under a handicap, and so we can't really expect the results from those programs, I think, to equal this that the Perry program did, the Perry School program. But I think you've stressed something in your report that seems tremendously important to me, and that is the more we have these early programs, and we relate those to, and we include very definitely and positively the parents in them,
mm-hmm.
as you know, in the Head Start program, parents are an essential part. In fact, you have a committee formed by parents, which under the law has to approve any teacher in the Head Start program. And there's a real involvement of parents in that program. It's more likely we'll get that involvement when children are very young than we get them up on the high school level, where a lot of parents don't know their kids anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have that involvement. So I think that's very important. And as you know, there is proposed a so-called Great Start program, which
yes.
really looks at children from birth to 3 years old. We pick that up then with the what little we do in terms of the Head Start program, and then we need on the primary level the early childhood specialist to continue that relationship to the whole child, as it were, and their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and all three of those programs has a heavy involvement in parenting.
Yeah.
So I'm happy that you brought this to us. I think it will continue to provide support for what I hope will be some major commitments from the legislature.
May I add one more thought on that? We envision that the elementary school can be the hub of all of these Great Start and all of these other programs, that it's a natural community where parents have, the people involved in it have similar interests, the school staff has similar interests, So that gives us a spark, and it gives the thing I think that's a little bit scary on the Great Start thing, program here is that your counselor, child development specialist, principal, kindergarten teacher are quite professional. They're well versed in the needs of a child, and those can become deeply involved, and that becomes the hub of it. And then combined with Great Start and so on, I can see just tremendous development. On the other hand, I think we've all been on committees and boards where we have an insurance salesman and this and that and the other, and we deal with a lot of, it becomes amateur hour rather than utilizing the professionals, which certainly should be in the picture.
Well, something very important to that, I know that when I was working on the Head Start program in the last biennium, and I did not want that program to be under education, because I said traditionally schools have not wanted to take on any needs and responsibilities. So we're overloaded now, our job is teaching. And Randy Hitz, the specialist in early education, said, that's exactly why I wanted to be in education, so that educators will wake up to their full responsibilities a little bit better. So thank you very much for
coming.
Thank you. Subcommittee is adjourned. We will convene at your own watch.
Today is April 17, 1989, Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education, convening at 1:30 p.m.
Yeah. The Subcommittee on Education will come to order. We have Senate Bill, A. Engross Senate Bill 524, establishing licensing requirements for dietitians. Perhaps we should lead off today by having whoever is representing the dietitians and lobbying for this bill come forward. Give us an explanation, if you would.
Bring out the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nan Heim, and today I am here representing the Oregon Dietetic Association. It is a statewide organization of about 600 registered dietitians who work mainly in academic and hospital settings. And with me is Sonia Connor, who works at the University of Oregon Health Sciences Center and who is chair of the licensure committee. We are here today in support of Senate Bill 524, and we'd be happy to go through it with you. Is that how you'd like to start out first?
Yes, why not?
Sure. Okay. The first section is definitions.
Okay.
The important one there is licensed dietitian. The key part, I think, about this bill, if I could just give a little background, is that the organization has been working for licensure for a number of years. This time what we did differently is we worked first within the association and then outside with other interest groups to try to meet objections that had been previously raised. For example, the hospitals, the Oregon Medical Association, Fred Meyer with their nutrition stores. And we are very proud of the fact that these organizations do not oppose this bill, that we have met their concerns. Section 2 is probably the critical section. It says that no person who is not licensed shall practice or attempt to practice using the words or letters LD or licensed dietitian. In other words, we are not attempting to interfere with any person who chooses to describe himself or herself as a nutritionist, or a dietitian, or a diet counselor, or whatever, except that that person could not use LD or licensed dietitian in connection with his or her name unless he or she became licensed. Section 3 describes the written application. Sonia, if you want to put anything in, go ahead. Process, Section 4 is the requirements. Why don't you speak to those?
Well, the requirements were established.
Would you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Yes, I'm Sonia Connor, Chair of the Licensure Committee for Oregon Dietetic Association, and professionally, I'm a member of the Department of Medicine at Oregon Health Sciences University. In Section 4, the requirements for granting the license were based on requirements that had been established by our dietetic profession over the years, and requires that one have certain academic, meet certain academic requirements, and that they show knowledge of the Code of Ethics and complete continuing education requirements established by our profession.
Could you tell me under 2 there, starting on line 4, what would be the nature of the approval? How specific would the courses be and so forth? I'm referring to your with a major course of study in human nutrition, dietetics, food and nutrition, or food systems management approved by the board. Does this mean that they would have to have a university or college degree in dietetics?
Well, it can be dietetics, or it can be human nutrition, and there are two or three different types of degrees that will give the coursework that will meet these requirements. And
so
typically it's nutrition, foods and nutrition, or dietetics and institutional management are two that are most common.
So you would anticipate that you would identify certain degree programs at various institutions that met this requirement?
Right, correct. And this has been done for 20 years at the national level to establish registration of dietitians, which is not a legal term.
Okay.
Then Section 5 talks about the conditions of waiver. People who can be admitted in the beginning for licensure who are registered dietitians, basically if they are, you're a registered dietitian at the American Dietetic Association currently, you would meet the requirements for licensure, and so there are a couple of other ways that we're trying to accommodate potentially people who aren't dietitians, who aren't registered at the American Dietetic Association, but have are baccalaureately trained nutritionists that would qualify for licensure. So that is what is described in Section 5 and 6. Section 7 discusses the duration and expiration of the license, and that we plan to have the license renewed every 5 years, which seems to have worked at the national level with our continuing education, which those requirements, that is renewed every 5 years. And so we chose to do that to keep the paperwork and administrative business related to licensure at a minimum.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Can I ask a question? You have a grandfather clause in Section 5, is that right?
Yes.
Is that pretty much standard across the country right now?
Yes.
That is a standard one.
The 21 states with two new ones, there's 23 states and the Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico who have established licensure laws, and this is similar, the grandfather clause, and it's similar to the one that was used 20 years ago when we established registration at the national level. It seems to be working.
So this is pretty much boilerplate language all the way through?
Yes. Yes. This is, yes.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I don't know if it's appropriate to ask now, but I think I will. I understand this is not a new issue, but it's fairly new to me. Can you talk a little about some of the things that happen in the marketplace that makes this sort of thing so important and so necessary?
Well, what has happened is that as nutrition and diet counseling have become, you know, more and more important in our society, as science has, scientific research has shown more and more diet being related to disease, that we're seeing a need for people who want to be counseled, you know, about, say, low-fat eating, for example, and how to lower your cholesterol level, and that there is a need for people to be licensed within our profession so that we can regulate ourselves, so that we won't have people practicing and not keeping up with the profession in ways that, so that it isn't based on science. So it's regulation of our own profession, so that we can monitor this, and also to allow the public to be able to identify people who have undergone this type of training.
Yeah, tell me what kinds of bad things go on out there. I mean, I really am ignorant of this whole area.
Well, the biggest thing is that basically people expect health professionals to be licensed, and as we've worn these buttons the last few months, people have said, I can't believe you're not licensed. We think people who are in the health profession who are providing counseling is that seems to be coming from the health profession. They expect them to be licensed. So basically what happens is that people can't tell. Now, the public has no way of telling, or very little way of telling, who is has this training and who doesn't. And I think having licensure will help establish that.
Let me play
also, we have no way of regulating people within our profession. If someone in our profession is practicing not according to the ethics or according to established scientific standards of nutrition, we really don't have a way to protect the public from these people.
If I may continue, Mr. Chair, I want to play devil's advocate for a minute, and I think of all the new diet books that come on the market every year, and you should eat this and you shouldn't eat that, and the turnover is just incredible. It's the same sort of thing that it's new advice and it may not necessarily be scientifically based. I mean,
it's very complicated because you have nutrition, there's the science of nutrition, and then there's also nutrition that is not based on science at all, and it's based on someone going to bed at night and having a dream and getting up and writing about it. That it's not based on anything. I mean, it's not based on any science which allows you to study something and be predictable. So people can't tell that. Well, then you also have science that, you know, information that's coming out about science that is good, but you can then have good translation and bad translation. So that's even more difficult, I think, for the public to determine the good from the bad translation. And they can, you know, be taking science and translating in a way that is very inappropriate and won't provide the action that they're expecting.
There are a lot of suits because people go to get some kind of nutrition advice and get terrible advice. And
well, the problem is there aren't, because it's very difficult to prove, you know, cause and effect. Plus, there's no means. People don't have a means to bring suits. There's no body to make complaints to. So if people feel that they haven't been counseled properly, there really isn't a body to go to. If you can go to the OMA or the licensure board for doctors if you are unhappy with the service you receive. But as far as nutrition counseling or diet counseling, there isn't any place to go that can, I think, handle or even consider these kinds of problems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to declare a possible conflict of interest? This might reduce the number
the sale of diet
quacks of books that you could sell.
There are a lot of those out there. I think I won't know. Thank you.
Except that I might say that, you know, this is a free enterprise, and I think that people should have the choice, you know, to make decisions, and people do base their decisions on science, and people make decisions in their life not based on science, and we recognize the right of people to do this, and we're here because we would just like the people who wish to make their choices based on science to have a way to determine how to do this.
Thank you. What's your going?
Okay, so we are now at the makeup and duties of the licensing board, which just describes typical licensing board, which consists of 7 members, 4 dietitians, one physician who has been trained in clinical nutrition, and 2 members of the general public.
Where are you going to find a physician trained in clinical nutrition?
I'm married to one.
Is he the only one in the state of Oregon?
No, there are actually a number, a growing number. A colleague, or also Roger Illingworth, there are a number of the medical school.
Because the medical schools haven't been noted for teaching doctors
nutrition. No, and actually, you know, we do have a required freshman course in nutrition that we've had now for 13 years or so. So there's more and more coming up. We have a young one, a fellow that's with us now, who is now came to get the big nutrition book, and he's going to take the boards, the certifying boards. So there is a growing number, and we've had a number of fellows, for example, Beth Phillipson, who's at Providence, Doug Rothrock, who is a practicing cardiologist. There are a growing number of physicians that we can call upon, who I think would be happy to serve in this capacity. So that's...
Should have stepped into that one, didn't you?
Right in, that's great. Okay, and then we've got the revocation and conditions for removing, you know, the license of someone, which I think are probably very standard types of procedures, and we would hope that many of those complaints, we would expect the majority of them to be resolved without litigation, but it's included in there in the event that we need to Who had it, Dan?
We inadvertently skipped over section 10, which is the duties of the board.
Okay.
And that's fairly standard.
Yes, we plan to hire an executive secretary only at the number of hours it takes to administer this. We want to keep the administration of this as small as possible, and who will then do the paperwork required for this. And then the collection of fines and fees, which the fees have not been established, but I think will not be large. And the reason that the fees will not be large is because we are not starting with a blank piece of paper. Because of our registration at the national level, we have a standardized examination, which costs usually $250,000. That's been in place now for 20 years, and we can use that. And we also have our code of ethics.
Did you say $250,000?
To establish a standardized examination costs in the vicinity of $250,000.
But you've already got one you can use.
But we don't have to do that. No.
Thank you.
No, we've done that.
I lost it there.
No, we've done that. So I said, we won't have to do that, so we don't have to top up that money. And we have our code of ethics that's already established. It's been recently revised. The standards of practice that we're working in our profession on specialty certification. So we don't have to do that. Basically, we just have to implement this. And there's very little money involved because it... We will get money from the general fund, which will be paid back. So it will be this system will be self-supporting. And then 16 and 17 is the enforcement of the bill, which I think is standard probably to most licensure bills in the state. And then 18 and 19 is the implementation and initial funding. And again, we're asking, I think, for $20,000 from the general fund to startup operation, which then we will be paid back. Will be paid back.
It seems fairly low for 600. I don't know. Did exec work out a budget on this? Carla, you got a budget on that? And LFO got a budget too?
Mr. Chair, I have copies of the fiscal impact statement.
Okay. All right.
Fine.
Often they ask for more like 50,000, don't they?
Well, I'm thinking about the fact that you've got the AG prices going up, and that's what bothers me.
We'd be happy to take 50,000.
You have to pay it back.
You have to pay it back.
Oh, we'll pay it back. We're not
going to
spend it.
Right.
Mr. Chair, do you have a sense of what your fees might have to be to begin to pay this back?
We can go into those just a minute here. We do have a report from our fiscal officer. We'll take that when we finish it. We have to look at the question of cost. Go ahead.
Based on other states, the other states have had typical first entry fees of around $100 to become licensed. And the ones that are licensing dietitians only seem to have renewal fees or fees of $30 to $35. And I'm not clear whether that's per year and whether then that might end up being $100 every 5 years is what we're looking at possibly. And, but should this be favorable, we're getting information now from all of the states who have had this so that we can set up a correct budget that and ask for the appropriate amount of money.
Senator Crowell?
I was just thinking that they'll probably get everybody signed up for the initial one quickly in the first year if the board operates. And then what will happen is that then there'll be 4 or 5 years until everybody renews all at once, and you might have a cash flow problem. I don't know how you work that out, but there must be some way of doing that. If you get a lot of money in immediately, you pay back your loan immediately, and then whether or not you'd have enough new membership and renewals, because renewals won't come for 5 years, to keep you going.
We will look at that when we first establish the budget so that we are sure we will have enough money to follow that, and we will plan. We will not proceed until we feel that we do have sufficient funds to run that 5 years. That we will consider this carefully in making our budget.
Well, you know, one of the blessings you get is once you get one of these boards, you have to report back to the legislature every 2 years and tell us how you're doing and get your budget approved and all of that kind of stuff. And so
So you'll have somebody else who'll be helping you mind your business.
Good. Well, that's very good.
Won't say that.
I've existed 20 years, my entire working life on grants, federal grants, other grants, and we have to do this at least once a year. So that won't be anything new.
But they might have to stagger their re-registering or something.
Yeah.
5 years is usually like the time.
We'll look at that. We may have to make a course correction there. And we will if that looks like we need to.
Is that it? All right.
Son, you did have a statement to give. Would you like to? We probably touched on most of it by this point.
Well, unless you want to add something, you can put your statement in for the record if you want to.
I'll put the statement in for the record. I guess the thing that, just to reemphasize what Nan said, that this bill is very different from the bills that have been of this type that have been before the legislature before, and that we have excluded the term nutritionist and have focused in on actually licensing professional dietitians, and then also making provision for academically trained nutritionists. And to point out that this act is really self-regulatory and I think will not impinge on the rights of other people to provide nutrition information, diet counseling, whatever. So that again, I think we have not restricted employment or other opportunities of people wishing to provide nutrition information.
Let me ask a couple. Go ahead.
I was curious about that last point because given the social implication these days of diet, why the term is dietitian rather than something else. I understand the larger sense of that, but today, because of the kind of books that Representative Peterson sells out of her bookstore and everywhere else, and the people on television, the people waking up in the middle of the night with this great idea about diets, is this necessarily a term of art that you really want to try to perpetuate, or do you want to pull us back into as the intenders of bringing us back into more repute?
Well, the reason is that this is the name of the profession, the dietetic profession, and that we are, our professional group is the American Dietetic Association. And so that is where, you know, our credentialing has been. These are the people who have provided the nutrition counseling, you know, through hospitals, through wellness programs. And so that is simply the name of our profession. And I think it is appropriate.
Okay. The second question, did you, when this went through the Substance Committee, did they discuss the violation levels in Section 16?
Not specifically. I didn't address those specifically.
A violation of any tax class B misdemeanor, and I'm wondering if there was any discussion in the committee about why that level of violation. Is that similar in other violations in other boards or acts?
It is. This is very standard from other licensure acts of dietitians in the United and other states.
No, in Oregon.
In Oregon,
my question is the level of the misdemeanor charge for violations. And I'm just wondering.
I don't know that.
We're directing the district attorney to prosecute all persons, which is an unusual. 16 is an unusual statement because that's a given, and I'm just wondering why that language is in there. But. I'm going to hold up the bill for that.
I think I would need to ask Jody Fisher, who helped us with this. But
okay. I wanted to ask a couple questions. First, apparently this is proposed that this operate some respect under or within the department, the division of health. I don't see any reference. I've been looking for the reference in the bill to the status of this licensing board with reference to the division of health. The health
being part of the health division.
Health division of the Department of Human Resources.
On section one, line 21, it says division means the health division of the Department of Human Resources.
I know it's defined there, but I can't find any reference to it elsewhere.
There is under section 15.
Under section 15.
item one, to do with the money.
It says all money received by the Health Division under this act, but under this act, there's no provision for it receiving the money. Unless there's, I've missed it there.
Continuous appropriations.
Page three, line one.
Okay, page two, the bottom. There it is.
There's establishment within the Health Division. Okay, I kept looking for that, couldn't find it. All right. All right, fine. Did you tell us how many you thought would become qualified as licensed dietitians in Oregon?
There are 600 members, there are 600 registered dietitians in Oregon who would be qualified, and in addition to that, there are other academically trained nutritionists. These are public health nutritionists and other academically trained nutritionists that would come under this. I am just guessing that maybe 100, maybe, potentially, that additional to that. And it is voluntary, so these are potential people. So I'm guessing on the academically trained nutritionists, the number that might possibly qualify.
So you think about 500 or 600 might be?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's probably a good number.
And what did you thought the fee would be for licensing?
The initial fee, I looked based on other states, has been around $100.
For 5 years?